Hi, and welcome back to Forecast, the show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. I'm just back from Chicago, where I attended the American Economic Association annual meeting, and I thought I'd do a quick brain dump on the meeting, because the scientific culture there is just so incredibly different than what you see in geosciences. Compared to AGU, right, the meeting is cheap. It's $40 to go to this meeting. But of course, it was held in Chicago in winter and over the weekend, all of which means cheap hotel rates. And they have no coffee, no beer. So all the things you kind of get as bonuses at AGU, you don't get at the economics meeting. And the audiovisual is actually pretty bad because it's held in hotel rooms as opposed to a conference facility. The other weird thing, well, maybe it's not weird because they don't give you free beer, but they have, I'm not really exaggerating here, maybe like 50 different cocktail receptions that are hosted by the individual organizations that are hanging out at the meeting. Really big difference in the culture of presentation is that most of the sessions have what's called a discussant. So you give your paper, then the discussant gets up and they talk for about 5 minutes. They kind of summarize your paper, and then, you know, really they kind of critique it and tell you what they think you should have done or could have done better. Now, there is a little bit of grandstanding here, but overall, it's pretty fair-minded and useful critiques that you tend to see. Another big difference is that the entire job market takes place at this meeting. If you're a top candidate, you know, you're going to have something like 25 interviews maybe, and you're going to present what they call the job interview paper for a few minutes at each one of these interviews. The weird thing about it is that they take place in hotel rooms, which to me and some geoscientists who are commenting on Twitter about this just seems completely bizarre and potentially uncomfortable. And I went to a lot of sexual harassment concerns, but it's the community standard there. So a totally different way of looking for jobs. The economics field in general, it seems like it has a bit of an existential crisis about their overall usefulness to society after their failure to predict anything about the Great Recession. So they've done quite a lot of work to try and establish how other fields are citing the papers in their community. I had a lab visit to the University of Chicago where I talked to some economists, and I learned that the damage function, so the very simple function that links global warming to the damage from global warming in terms of the economy, is actually underlain by very, very little data, but there's now a massive effort to try and increase the data density behind those numbers. Differently than in geosciences, they have five top journals that essentially are the known top five, like they're called the top five. And in geosciences, this would be much more diffuse. It would kind of depend on your specific field, which are viewed as being the top specialty journals. And you could succeed in academia by publishing in a wide variety of these, including journals like Science or Nature, or in many cases, not publishing in Science or Nature. In fact, for young academics in economics, there's no incentive to publish in Science and Nature, so they don't get any professional credit. Usually, sort of as a net zero in terms of promotion and tenure, having a paper in Nature, and it might even be seen as a negative. It might be seen as an end run around a rigorous review process at the top five. The papers themselves are quite different, so they're shifting more towards empirical studies and less away from theory, but still, they're often observational, so they're not beginning with a process-level study about leaf-level photosynthesis and trying to scale up to the globe. They're often at a very observational level, and because of that, they're based on statistical relationships, and what that means is that they, in many cases, have to do just an incredibly large amount of work on what they call robustness checks, and robustness checks for them are something on the vein of, well, how do you know that this didn't cause what you're seeing? How do you know that this isn't actually behind that particular regression? And it seems that there's a much higher threshold for what constitutes a sufficient robustness check. There's a lot of sessions on what they call nudging. So this is the idea that you can nudge people's behavior in ways that would be reducing, for example, water or energy consumption. Huge observational programs here, looking at things like billing, consumption data, how that interfaces with lifestyle and income, things like this. So a pretty large community on that. And the effects they see, you know, they're interesting scientifically and sociologically, but they tend to be down in the single digits, usually the low single digits, so not a very big effect. And I talked to some people about why this is, and there were a couple of thoughts that, you know, even if it is only a couple of percent, it's actually still a lot of money involved at that level. Secondly, that the big policy decisions are well understood. So economists know quite well that the best way, the most efficient way to get the kind of climate mitigation we want is just taxes. But in general, that's a known phenomenon, and in many cases, it's just not working. So they've moved on to these almost kind of nibbling around the edge type questions, which are, from a research point of view, also still quite interesting from them. So that's a quick overview of some of the themes I picked up at the economics meeting, not the sort of the details. I also visited the University of Chicago, like I said, had some great meetings there organized by Malte Jensen. And then went up to Northwestern just a couple of days ago, where I was hosted by Yara Axford. So Yara, thanks a lot for that. And also Malte, I really appreciate what you did there. Today, I am interviewing an old friend of mine, Noah Diffenbaugh, who is working at Stanford University, is tenured there. Noah and I met something like 2005 at one of these science boot camps that NCAR puts on for either young faculty, young stage scientists, or graduate students. And we just happened to hit it off and have a random discussion about wine and climate interactions. And that led to, you know, I'm not super active, but ongoing collaboration for several years that led to a few papers, including one on the effects of extreme temperatures on wine production in future climates. And Noah is probably best known for his work on extremes, just trying to understand the frequency of extremes in the current climate, how anthropogenic activities have affected that, and how they will continue to affect that going forward. What I didn't really realize is that he also has a big background in paleoclimate, which came about through a very happenstance way. And this interview is kind of different in the sense that, well, it's more philosophical than a lot of the interviews are. And a lot of what we talk about isn't the details of the science. It's kind of how Noah got into doing the science and why he's doing what he's doing and how he thinks about those kinds of science questions. So for anybody out there who's a young scientist, a graduate student or a postdoc, I hope that the interview will prove useful and give you some hope that your own bizarre pathway into science really isn't that unusual. So, you know, if you've seen Noah around meetings, you know he's always very well dressed. He's always wearing a nice sports coat. He looks professional, and it's different than the way that most geoscientists dress. And I've always been curious about why that is. So we start off on that topic. Here it is, my interview with Noah Diffenbaugh. So we had a piece in Nature Geoscience maybe like, 2 months ago. And they were basically saying that one of the problems with geosciences is that it's not very diverse. And one of the reasons that it's not very diverse is that for huge chunks of the population, they don't see themselves as a geoscientist because they just look different than geoscientists. And the classic comment about AGU, just sort of like this, a sea of polar tech, but You're actually quite different. I think I've seen you at, you know, numerous meetings over the years, and you're always nicely dressed. Like, you're always wearing a sports coat. Can you talk about, like, why do you do that? Is it just like a personal preference, or are you trying to make any kind of a statement that geoscientists don't have to look like dirtbags?
Yeah. So this actually started when I started my faculty job at Purdue. You know, what I'm going to tell you is a true story. I think I actually have like visual proof of it somewhere. But when I arrived at Purdue, so this was summer of 2004, I went to get my ID card. The ID card office is down in the bowels, literally the bottom basement of the student union building. And everybody, staff, faculty, students, whatever, goes ID cards there. And so I went down to get my ID card and said, well, I'm here, you know, I'm just starting, I'm here to get my ID card. And she pulls out the undergrad paperwork And I was, oh no, actually I need the professor card. And so
you do, to be fair, you do look quite youthful.
Yeah. So I am not as young as I was in 2004. But you know, then I started teaching at Purdue, and a colleague of mine, Andy Freed, and I taught a class called Geoscience in the Cinema. You know, we basically filled the auditorium every semester. So depending on what size room we were in, you know, we were teaching 180 to 230 undergrads, you know, non-science majors, no prereqs. I literally started wearing a coat and tie in order to, you know, make it clear that I was there for the faculty paperwork, not the undergrad paperwork. Also, I mean, I think when I started my faculty job at Purdue, apart from the teaching, just one, I was aware that I looked younger than I was. And mm-hmm. I think also just to, you know, heading into my first faculty job as an assistant professor, I guess to convey a sense of professionalism. And there actually was, I had one faculty colleague who said, wow, I really appreciate that you're dressing nicely. You're wearing a collared shirt to work. It's really given me wow. permission to do that also. I felt uncomfortable doing that. I guess I take it seriously. And I think, you know, even though I was raised in a very, you know, liberal environment in many, many ways, there was a sense that you present yourself cleanly and professionally. And I think I inherited some of that.
Let's go back to those early years that you just mentioned. So you, I think everyone who's on the show has some kind of unusual background, but I think yours is by far the most unusual. You did all of your K-12 schooling at Mount Madonna, yoga retreat in the Santa Cruz Mountains. How did you end up there?
I ended up there by, you know, my parents moving there.
Where did they come from before that?
Yeah, so Mount Madonna Center is it's a intentional community. If you walked onto campus out of colloquial America, you might call it a hippie commune, but it's an intentional community. And certainly in the 1970s and early 80s when it was founded, it would really look like a hippie commune.
Well, you were born in what, like 74, 75?
Yeah, so I was born in 74, and my parents were students at UC Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. One of the features of the 70s, in addition to the anti-Vietnam protests and the continuation of the civil rights movement, another feature was, you know, this sort of discovery of spirituality, particularly Eastern spirituality and yoga. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, with the Beatles going over to India and, mm-hmm. You know, Be Here Now and that whole movement, there was a yoga teacher that came over from India and moved to California. His name is Baba Hari Das, and my parents were students of his, and they were part of a group that founded this intentional community. It's in the lineage of the American communalism movement. You know, this was the 1970s version, so, you know, it was a place where people could study and practice yoga. And from the very beginning, you know, education was a really big component of it. So we moved there in 1978 when it was founded. We were the four of us, my parents and my brother and I were half of the original eight residents of the community. And now it has a stable population of about 100. There are a couple of activities there in addition to the long-term community. One is there's a school. Mm-hmm. My mom was one of the founders of the school and was the principal for a long time. That school was started to educate the residents of the community and that, you know, the broader community within kind of Santa Cruz County that were also affiliated with the center, but it quickly became a school for, you know, whoever wanted to.
Oh, okay. So you didn't have to be a member of the community to go there after a while.
Exactly.
I guess when you're a kid, like any kid, no matter what you grow up in, that environment just seems normal to you usually. But you went there when you were, I think, 4 years old. So you would have already had a consciousness about what the outside world in Santa Cruz was like when you were growing up and going to that school and living in that environment. Did it seem like you were doing something really different than mainstream society?
Yeah. So I think that my time in Santa Cruz before we moved up to the mountain, that was pretty continuous. You know, the community of people
that, you know, my peers and that community was all the same community. It was, you know, so it was going from Santa Cruz up to the mountain was this, you know, that was unnoticeable. You know, I think that one of the features of the community, one of the real geniuses of the founding and philosophy of the community is, and that has enabled it to last as long as it has, from its founding and all the way through, it's been very open. You know, the school being open so very quickly, students from the Santa Cruz community, unaffiliated with the intentional community, were enrolling. You know, once some of us started getting into schools like Stanford and Yale and Princeton, then
everyone was like, "Oh, this
interest increased quite a lot." Yeah. And the other thing that right from the beginning is that the center started running programs for the broader world. And you know, if you go down the list of kind of seminars and programs that happened at the center from right in the early years, the late 70s and into the 80s, you know, it's a who's who of, you know, anthropology and mindfulness. And, you know, so it gets thousands and thousands of people just attending programs there every year. And now when I go, you know, I speak on panels or see alumni groups or, you know, around the Bay Area, pretty much everywhere, someone says, "Oh, you're from Mount Madonna? Yeah, I went up there for such and such retreat." The fact that it has not been closed, it's not been a cult, you know, has a very open, very permeable membrane with the community has really helped it survive. And so that was the case for us growing up as kids. You know, we went down and played Little League in Watsonville. You know, our team was pretty much all rural. We were up from the mountains and then there were, you know, a lot of people whose families worked on the farms in the Pajaro Valley. And, you know, that was our Little League team, right? I mean, so we were starting with Little League, and then many of us played volleyball growing up. That was our one high school sport. We were Volleyball Monthly Team of the Month.
Do you still play?
I don't. I play basketball here on campus in the kind of in the open gym. Volleyball is hard on the body, and it's not as good of a workout. So I'm too old for volleyball.
You know, one thing that's kind of struck me looking at your collaborations and also the sort of limited collaboration that we have working on wine and climate is that you have like a real sense of openness and interest in what other people are doing and not trying to, at least from my perspective, it doesn't seem like you're trying to really like nail down a very specific disciplinary expertise and saying like, okay, I'm the world expert on this one narrow topic. Do you think that your experiences at Mount Madonna are partially guiding that exploration in your career, or is that just, you know, an innate personality trait that you have?
No, I think it has a lot to do with where I grew up and how I grew up, and a very universalist perspective. There's a definite spiritual philosophy and practice at Mount Madonna Center, but from a religious point of view, you know, it was always my parents and Baba Hari Das, the yoga teacher there, and the school. You know, it was all very, very clear that there was no particular religion, and there are people from all different religions there practicing yoga. In my house, you know, we probably celebrated the big six religious festivals, you know, two each from Christianity, Judaism, and Hinduism. I don't think it's anyone else's big six, but that kind of lack of boundaries definitely influenced me. And I think also I was an undergrad at Stanford back in the early to mid 90s. And at that point, our Earth Systems program, that actually, you know, that altered the course of my life. That class and that major at the time, and I think is still the case, you know, were very much about interactions between different components of the Earth system, mm-hmm. you know, feedbacks, nonlinearities. I don't think they were called tipping points at the time. I think that definitely contributed to my intellectual architecture. And there is this whole kind of philosophical discussion about interdisciplinary education and should, you know, interdisciplinarity happen kind of at the undergraduate level, like it does in our systems, like it was when I was in that major. I should be taking people who have this real disciplinary training as undergrads and then introducing interdisciplinarity later after they, you know, have quote a disciplinary grounding. And I guess I only know the way that I did it and the way that
which is starting off with that broad background.
Yeah, exactly. Which is starting out when you're young and you're open. And, you know, I had a real aha heavens opening up and angels singing, you know, with Earth Systems 10, you know, I had all my paperwork declared. I hadn't filed it, but I had it all signed. I had an advisor to be a religious studies major. Oh. Well, so I came in pre-med. I grew up on a commune, basically, right? Like, there's doctors and lawyers, and I mean, the outside world, like, what's in the outside world if you're not living in the community, right? So I think we see a lot of undergrads, you know, coming in, they don't have a very broad view of what they can be in the future, right? And a lot of our undergraduate education is breaking down that preconception. So doctor was the thing.
That was just the sort of the starting point, but you hadn't put a lot of effort into decomposing why you were doing that.
Right. I mean, I had to write like a college application, and I had had it at that level. But, you know, where I really hadn't put a lot of effort in was Chem 31. The first midterm here, you know, at that point was like probably in the third week or something like that. So I lasted about 2.5 weeks as a pre-med major.
What did you leave? Was it because you liked the Earth system stuff so much, or because you disliked the pre-med stuff so much?
Yeah, I got totally weeded out by freshman chemistry. I tell the Earth Systems 10 class here, you know, I got a 28 out of 100, not 28 out of 30, 28 out of 100 on the first Chem 31 midterm.
Were you intentionally not studying?
That's an important question. no, so I was studying hard. I was doing a lot of reading for like the freshman philosophy class, you know, the
right.
Cultures, Ideas, and Values, it was called at that point. I really enjoyed the reading, you know, as we were like reading Zhuangzi and Confucius, and I was working a lot on that. There wasn't a midterm in that class at the level of the Chem 31 midterm, that's for sure. So yeah, I probably didn't, I wasn't super optimized about how I thought about where I was putting my effort. I was putting my time into what was yeah. interesting to me. But, you know, the interesting thing is that then, you know, so I had all my my paperwork at the end of my freshman year signed, and I just hadn't filed it to declare religious studies. And I kind of, you know, had a cooling off period over the summer, and you know, I mean, religious studies was familiar, obviously.
It would have been easy, perhaps, to do that.
Yeah, yeah, it would have been what was, yeah, it wouldn't have been much of a risk in terms of extending myself beyond what I was familiar with on a day-to-day mm-hmm. basis. And so I ended up taking in the fall of my sophomore year, I ended up taking a geology class. It was environmental geology. It was co-taught by a professor and an adjunct who actually was a practitioner. He actually was like a land planner, like a land use planner.
All right. Huh?
So the class was kind of about environmental geology and land use planning. Everyone in the class was all working on some aspect of a land use plan for a particular city. It happened to be Gilroy, California that year. They switched between year, you know, year to year, they would switch the city. And so I really enjoyed it. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll kind of see how this, what's the next thing in this. So then the internet was very new at that time. And I had not been on it.
I hadn't until I went to grad school, actually.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. So this was sort of in fall of 93, I guess. And
yeah, I was first on in, I think, spring of 94.
Yeah, precisely. Exactly. So exactly that time, you know, so I had to go to this like giant book of classes and go page by page. And I found this Earth Systems 10 and I thought, oh, wow, this is like, okay, this is really cool. I'll give this a try. And so I took that winter quarter of my sophomore year, and that was, you know, like this, it must be a cliche, it never really happens kind of, oh my goodness, this is amazing. I can't believe how all of this fits together.
What was it in particular about the class, or was it just the totality of the feedbacks and the interactions and the relevance to life and things like that?
Yeah, I think it was that totality. It was how different components fit together, how there are unexpected interactions, how different timescales, you know, produce different results. And, you know, your question was kind of about disciplinarity and versus something else. And I think since then, you know, have really been driven by just trying to understand how stuff works. And coming back to your question about, you know, how do I think of myself as sort of as a disciplinarian or pursuing questions within a discipline versus not, you know, when I arrived at Purdue, somewhere in that first week, you know, I walked in to the mail room and there was my name on a mailbox and it said, you know, Noah Diffenbaugh, assistant professor of atmospheric sciences. And I said, excuse me, I'm, you know, our department is called Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. I'm an assistant professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. You know, so I think I've had a sort of visceral reaction to being defined by a discipline, and I don't actually see the world that way. So there was a very wise person who once said, if you can say what discipline you're in, you're probably doing something old. And,
that sounds like something that John Foley would say.
Yeah, someone like that, exactly. So I think I certainly don't want to create the impression that I'm against disciplines, but I think that, you know, I'm not a historian of science by any means, but my sense is that all the disciplines that we now acknowledge used to not be disciplines, right? So it's very clear that biogeochemistry is now a discipline.
Right, it's a section at AGU.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're at the point where you have, you know, scientific societies or sections of scientific societies, you have journals, mm-hmm. you have, in some cases, departments, you have faculty job descriptions, you have potentially graduate programs, or at least, you know, areas of emphases within graduate programs. At that point, you're basically a discipline, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that, I'm certain that biogeochemistry didn't arise because somebody said, oh, we're missing this discipline, and boy, you know, we need a discipline.
It bubbled up from the community.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There were people who were, you know, thinking about cutting edge questions. Disciplines at some point were interdisciplinary. I'm pretty sure that, you know, that pretty much everything arose from that we now see as a discipline arose from somebody feeling the constraints of the existing disciplines and wanting to answer questions that weren't getting answered. And then the institution arises around that. And I think that's where the spirit of that statement that if you can say what discipline you're in, you're probably doing something old. By the time you can say that this is my discipline, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it's not glib. It actually is old. It has an institution around it by the time you can identify it as a discipline.
Speaking of disciplines, I think you're probably best known for your work on climate extremes, but going back to your PhD work and continuing on through most of your career is an interest in paleoclimate. How did the interest arise for you? Was it from working with Lisa Sloan? And then how did you over time transition more towards modern and future climate interests?
So I often say to prospective PhD students that if I ever said out loud my motivation and what I was thinking, like, I don't think I would ever get admitted. So I'm going to give you a scoop. It's not a big one. But I don't think I've ever said it out loud before, is the point. Like, I essentially, you know, didn't go through adolescence and didn't really leave home until my mid-20s when I was already married and already had a kid. And so I basically went to grad school because I was going through adolescence from a psychological point of view. So after college, you know, my wife and I got married right at the end of college. And
when you were 22 or something like
that? I was 22. Yeah, I was 22. I was almost 23, but I was technically 22. And yeah, so spring quarter of my fifth year. And so, you know, we moved back to Mount Madonna. Oh. Yeah, and I taught science in the high school and coached volleyball, boys and girls.
Why did you go back? You felt like you needed a break from academia, or you felt like going home? What drew you back? Or did your wife also have connections there?
I met my wife, Polly, in college, actually mm-hmm. living in an intentional community on campus, off on campus. And we even had a community within the community. So the dorm, you know, it's a house, it's, you know, 45 people or something. It's still on campus, Synergy House, but it basically is an intentional community. It runs as an intentional community. So, but the thing is that people draw in, you know, in the housing draw. So we both ended up there, and then we had this other, what was called the commune within the Synergy House, and that was like 12 of us. And basically every student is entitled to half a room, essentially. And so we pooled our rooming resources. So we had 12 people, which meant we were entitled to 6 rooms. So we pooled our 6 rooms, and then we ended up with like 2 sleeping rooms, 2 study rooms, 1 in the loud study room and 1 in the quiet study room, a social room and a meditation room. And
so you had 6 bunk beds in one room or something like that, or?
Yeah, something like that. Although that would have been a little bit more organized.
Okay. All right. No, what was going on in these sleeping rooms?
I grew up in this intentional community, right? And I think people tend to think of it as being kind of this free love hippie place. And it was definitely hippies. It was founded by hippies. There's no, you could do history of America in the 60s, 70s and 80s.
And
it would all be there. There's no doubt. But it really was very, very disciplined, extremely disciplined. The people who lived there and really stuck were the people who, you know, basically, you know, transitioned from being the stereotypical Santa Cruz in 1974 hippies to, you know, living a very disciplined lifestyle, sober, substance-free, meditate every day, work hard every day, get an education, reconcile with your parents.
Were you trying to bring those elements to this sub-commune?
So I wouldn't say that I was bringing those elements, but I would say that I was very much a product of that place. So I, you know, there was a proposal by a young man named Matt, who was from Santa Barbara, and I don't remember his last name. He wanted, in one of these sleep rooms, he said, well, let's just like get rid of all the beds and let's just take all the mattresses and we'll just cover the floor with the mattress, all the mattresses, and you can just walk in and lay down anywhere.
Yeah, why not?
And I said, no, I'm having my own bed. And someone said, oh, well, we could just have all the beds, but it's too constraining to have them assigned to anybody. And I said, look, I'm sleeping in a bed and no one else is sleeping in my bed. And otherwise I'm out. Like, you'll have 11 people and then you'll have 5.5 rooms, which is the same as having 5 rooms, right? So I was very, my desk was in the quiet study room, not the loud study room. My bed was in the sleep room with assigned beds, and the meditation room, which was really that was really why I was participating in the commune, was because that got me the meditation room. It was actually an awesome laboratory for community, not only community living, but collective action and agreements. And, you know, we ran by consensus. And I mean, like, faculty meetings now are pretty mild compared to, we actually had a rooming meeting every quarter, and every person in the house had to agree on the full rooming assignment, right? So we ran by consensus, like Quaker codified consensus process.
What an amazing training for being a faculty member.
It really was. It was really incredible. And so, like, there was one quarter where actually, like, so it started out like everybody listed their first and second choices for rooming assignments, you know, there's, you know, 20 something rooms or whatever, and, you know, 40 something people. And there was one point where we had like the whole map, you know, so there's like all these sticky notes and every person's name and all the possible, you know, room assignments they could be in. This happened every quarter. And so we had the whole map ready to go and everybody was happy.
That's astonishing.
And so this is astonishing, right? And then somebody says, wait a second, I'm sorry, I have to block this because I see that everybody up on the map has their first or second choice except for Julia. And where Julia is not her first choice and it's not her second choice. And Julia said, look, I am really happy with this. I want this meeting to be done. I am totally happy to live here for the quarter. And the person said, no, this is not, I won't endorse this process because it has resulted in somebody not getting their first or second choice. Never mind that the person is satisfied, I'm blocking this. And we went back to the drawing board. And we ended up with a solution where everybody had either their first or second choice. And the absurdity of that is very obvious. But in terms of, I mean, we're in college, right? I mean, like, this isn't real life.
Yeah.
Great preparation for being a faculty member. Absolutely. Probably a pretty obvious living choice, given that I had grown up in an intentional community. Yeah. But then, you know, I think the main thing is that I never really left home, right? I grew up within an hour and a half drive of where I went to college. And I kind of always had, you know, psychologically, I was always, you know, had one foot at home and one foot at school. So, you know, I'd always planned to go back to Mount Madonna where I'd grown up. And,
oh, okay. Okay. So you had that plan initially.
Yeah. But it was because I hadn't gone through adolescence, you know, from a psychological point of view. I hadn't separated. I hadn't left home.
Well, for you, what does it mean psychologically to go through adolescence?
Well, so funny you should ask that. I have an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old, and a 12-year-old. So
you're in the middle of it.
Yes, I can tell you a lot about what it means. But, you know, to really grow up, you have to become independent. You know, I have a great relationship with my parents. There are plenty of people have great relationships with their PhD advisors, but at some point they've left. Really, the PhD is really saying, you are an independent scholar, that you could go into a dark room by yourself and come out with a result. you have to be alone in order to get there, right? And I think at some point, you know, I tell my students, it's like, at some point you're gonna realize that, like, I don't know what I'm talking about. You know, that you feel boxed in by having me as your advisor, and you're going to want to leave, and you have to get to that point.
And you hadn't reached that point with Mount Madonna until you actually went back there.
Exactly. So I mean, it was certainly awkward. You know, someone said about intentional communities, one person's joy is everyone's joy. One person's pain is everyone's pain. And one person's secret is everyone's secret. You know, I was entering as a you know, quote, adult member of the community, but these were people who, you know, seen me since, in many cases, I was in utero. I basically went through a very public adolescence as a, you know, 20-something year old.
What do you mean by a public adolescence? In terms of having a sort of typically rebellious activities or something
else? Yeah, sure. I mean, not typically. You know, I went all the way through high school, college, you know, literally till I was 26 without drinking, and I had to in order to, you know, that was part of my growing up. I think there's, you know, there's a lot that's been written about, you know, sort of, you know, the hero's journey and all, you know, Joseph Campbell type, you know, what are the stages of leaving and returning, and you know, that's kind of those mythologies are kind of a metaphor for what everybody goes through. And I think, you know, I went through that. I didn't do it when I was 12 or 13 or 14 or 15 or 18. I did it when I was, you know, in my 20s. Anyway, so that was why I went to grad school. I knew I was going to be drifting psychologically, you know, kind of finding myself, and I was certainly committed to, you know, my family. So I was kind of trying to figure out what to do with myself, and grad school seemed, as with many, many applicants that we see, you know, grad school seemed like a good idea when I didn't know what I was going to do. So I had to kind of figure out what I was going to do.
Right. Yeah.
If any of my past professors or advisors ever listen to this, I want to say I don't regret a thing about grad school, and it's worked out great. I'm very happy with how it worked out. But I went to grad school, and I made my grad school decision for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, like, well, why didn't you go farther away? If you wanted to leave home and experience an adolescence, why didn't you go to the East Coast?
This is the very point, right, about how immature I was, right? Leaving home to me meant moving from the top of the mountain 40 minutes down the hill to Santa Cruz.
So you moved 20 miles away, essentially.
2,000 feet down. Like, I basically moved from 2,000 feet elevation straight down to sea level. Like, that was leaving to me. That was as far as I could think.
I mean, did you even think about Santa Barbara or anywhere
no,
else?
No, so this is the thing. So I was going to go to UC Santa Cruz. And again, I just, you know, to all of my esteemed faculty at UC Santa Cruz, I'm very happy with how it worked out. But I was going to go to Santa Cruz. And so the question was not, am I going to study, you know, earth sciences at UC Santa Cruz or at, you know, Purdue or someplace even farther away, but rather, what will I study at UC Santa Cruz?
Oh, so you were looking for just something to study there.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
You knew you were going there.
So I had it narrowed down to psychology, which I had no background in, community studies, which I had no academic background in, but had some life experience with, or earth sciences.
You were casting a broad net.
Well, yeah. So I was casting a broad net academically, but an extremely narrow net geographically. And I have this discussion actually with my PhD students and postdocs, you know, frequently as they're thinking about what to do after their PhD. And, you know, I say, like, you can probably get away with constraining one dimension, but not more than one, right? Like, if you're going to constrain your geographic dimension for what you do after your PhD, then you probably can't also say, well, I'm only going to take research one universities, or I'm only going to take academia, right?
You might be stuck in an endless stream of postdocs, or you have to go into industry or something like that.
Exactly. So you can say, well, I want to be, you know, in the strongest, most supportive research environment I can possibly be in. That's one dimension. You probably can't also constrain yourself geographically if, you know, you probably go anywhere where you can get that job.
So you,
right?
I mean, you end up at Santa Cruz and you're constrained to work with, you know, Jim Zachos and Christina Ravello at least.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the good thing, and I say I wasn't reckless, right? I mean, I thought about this a lot. I did prioritize the fact that I had a bachelor's and master's degree in earth sciences as being an indication that might be of the three,
it might make the most sense.
That one might make sense. This is all a long way of me saying that if anybody had ever said, if any PhD applicant ever said,
I've got a year and a half year old. I'm going through adolescence. I know that I just want to be here at this university, but I'm considering earth sciences, community studies, and psychology. They'd have a hard time getting admitted, I guess is my point.
Yeah, you can't reveal the full inner turmoil at all times. So was Lisa Sloan your advisor?
I came in co-advised by Lisa and Paul Koch. And the idea was that I was going to work between the climate modeling and that Lisa, you know, was a world expert in paleoclimate modeling, and the stable isotope geochemistry that Paul Koch is a world expert in. What really happened was I started out doing both of those things. My work in the lab, isolating the collagen from Holocene seal bones and prepping those collagen samples for the mass spec, you know, that really confirmed what my research as a coterminal master's student had previously suggested, which was that I am really bad at lab work.
What was it about lab work that you were bad at?
My grandmother actually said to me once that, like, if you can get paid to do something that you enjoy doing for hours at a time every day, you're really lucky. I'm not a good coder, right? I'm not going to get a job in Silicon Valley as a coder. Mm-hmm. I'm not a good coder, but I like it. So the other way now that people are saying the same thing my grandma said is, like, if there's something that where you don't notice the passage of time when you're doing it, if you don't notice the passage of time, that might be a career that you like. You might feel fulfilled in that career. That might be an indicator. And in the lab with the chemicals, like, that never happened to me. I didn't have an instinct for it. I didn't have, the chemicals were hard for me. More importantly, like, it wasn't keeping me up at night thinking, like, how am I going to solve this problem? When I was working on it during the day, I definitely noticed the passage of time as I was waiting for the collagen to get extracted inside of the vial, or, you know, I can't even.
So you decided to go more for the coding, computer modeling part.
Paul Koch basically said, who was, you know, who's the stable isotope geochemist, he basically said, you're good at this other thing.
Yeah.
You've already submitted a manuscript. You just showed me results for a second manuscript. You have nothing on the other side. Do what's going well for you. Like, he basically set me free. And I really thank Paul for
kicking you out.
For setting me. Yeah, for kicking me out in a really gentle way.
You went on to Purdue, and I guess that's when I met you, sort of circa 2005 or so, something like that, at a workshop at NCAR.
Exactly.
But I think that's around the time when you were working with people like Filippo Giorgi and Jeremy Powell with the REG-CM3 model and doing a lot of your early work on changes in extremes. If I were to grossly oversimplify your work on that topic, it's something like extremes in heat are going to go up wildly, and it's going to create all kinds of problems.
Yeah, I think if you take decades worth of papers that have come out of my group and a whole lot of other papers from a whole lot of other groups and put them all together, yeah, I think that that's absolutely where we're at in terms of our understanding, not only of higher levels of greenhouse gases, you know, 800 parts per million in 2100, mm-hmm. which was kind of, you know, the A2 scenario that was in that particular 2005 paper that you're referring to, but also, you know, the IPCC AR4 and kind of CMIP3, you know, that generation of climate model simulations. But also now really for the Paris target or targets, right, the 2 degrees with ambition towards 1.5. And also, you know, now even for the global warming, the 1 degree of global warming that's already happened, you know, we're already seeing that level of global warming has increased both the probability and severity of extreme heat substantially in many parts of the world. At that time when we met, which I think is, you know, I actually often tell that story of meeting you and having that discussion in the elevator in the hotel about collaborating, like, of the value of scientific conferences and kind of saying yes to going places where people are getting together, right? I mean, you really can't predict which interactions are gonna come out of those situations and which ones are gonna result in fruitful collaborations and which ones aren't. And, you know, so for me, I say yes because I'm not good at predicting what's gonna work out and what won't. And if it's worthwhile 10% of the time, then that's totally worthwhile.
Let me come back to the extremes, and this will be a bit of a long-winded question, but it gets back to what you were saying earlier. When you think about what's going to control the change in extremes at any one location, not at a continental level, you're going to have, obviously, the direct changes from increases in greenhouse gases, changes in aerosols, changes in regional circulation patterns, and then, as you've talked about, the variability in fine-scale land surface processes in terms of how the energy budget is going into sensible latent heat, stomatal conductance, the size of the plant canopy, and things like that. So you have pretty big range of processes that are going to control the probability of, let's just say, hitting sort of quasi-fatal temperatures in the Middle East or something like this. Then you, from that, can then provide a probability, which might be interesting to a policy community. Let's say it's like a 15% probability that in the next 20 years, you're going to exceed a certain threshold of temperature, a certain number of days in the year. If you do, in fact, exceed that threshold, a policymaker might say, well, you only said this had a 15% probability, and then it happened. Therefore, your models are not useful for us. Whereas I think scientifically, we might have the idea that that's actually a very high probability of 15%. How do you approach that kind of discussion when you are talking with policymakers and formulating your own research on these topics?
The scientific communication, particularly the communication around climate predictability, climate change, in the time that I've been in the field has really evolved and has really evolved in a direction towards communicating probabilities and communicating risk. And the IPCC has been really instrumental in that. Others have as well, but certainly the IPCC and the 2012 report on the risk of extreme events, framing the potential changes in extreme events around risk, has been really instrumental for at least two reasons. One, highlighting that the risk of extremes and the risk of climate change more generally really results from the overlay of not only the physical hazards, not only the level of extreme heat or the the level of flooding or the severity of drought or the presence of a tornado or hurricane. So not only that physical hazard, but also how that physical hazard overlays with exposure and vulnerability. And that framing has been really critical. But then it's also been really important in terms of the probability, particularly within that hazard, that hazard dimension. So that risk framing from the IPCC has really helped orient communication around probabilities of different outcomes happening, probabilities of different levels of sea level rise, and decomposing what the uncertainties in those probabilities are, the different contributions of different sources of uncertainty to the overall probability distribution, but also for extreme events, and we've done a lot of work, say, looking at the level of heat, that used to be the record level. Say, if we look at the second half of the 20th century, what was the hottest conditions that occurred? And then asking, like, how likely is that level of heat to occur in different places at different levels of global warming?
And in general, much more likely.
Much more likely. And for a lot of our work, we've kind of literally iterated with the public around this question. So, we started out looking at, like, let's look at the hottest season of, say, the late 20th century or the second half of the 20th century. Take your baseline, right? You could say look at the hottest season in the instrumental record, right? And so then you can say, if we look out at, say, the Paris target, right? So first iteration, like once Copenhagen happened and there was a very clear international statement in 2009 of 2 degrees is the safe level of global warming, then I and many others in the community started saying, okay, well, what happens at 2 degrees, right? Like, we were doing all this 2100 stuff, and now the world's saying the target's 2 degrees. Well, is it really safe? Like, how are you, on what basis is it safe? That kind of catalyzed research on what happens at 2 degrees, right? So we said, let's look at the hottest season that's occurred in each part of the U.S. Or each part of the world, and look out at the 2 degree level of global warming and ask, how often does that happen? For a lot of areas of the globe, particularly in the tropics, where the year-to-year variability is a lot lower, that even at 2 degrees, the result was like 100% of the time being hotter than what used to be the hottest summer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so when the first paper, I think the first paper we had on that is post-Copenhagen, it came out in 2009, and it very, the abstract was very, like, very explicit about this is why we're looking at the 2-degree level, or at this sort of time period. You know, in the Southwest, the numbers, the percentage of summers was, you know, getting up, you know, 80-90%. And then there were other parts of the U.S. that, you know, were 50-75%. And in the public communication about that paper, I kept getting asked, well, so are you saying this is the new normal? And I kept saying, well, no, that's, you know, what, actually what we did was we looked at the late 20th century, and we looked at each grid point, and we found the hottest season. You know, I went through this whole explanation of why it wasn't the new normal. And I kept having this discussion over and over again. And I remember the day I walked into the lab and I said, you know what, forget it. Everyone's asking us, is this the new normal? Let's just ask, is this the new normal? If that's the question, so now we had this first iteration of kind of that 2-degree statement in Copenhagen, then informing the research community, feeding back into the research community to start looking at 2 degrees. We started looking at 2 degrees. The public said, oh, well, are you saying this is going to be the new normal? We said, okay, well, let's ask that question. And then what turned out, then we started doing this work asking, because of that question from the public, we did this work asking, at what point will it be the new normal, right? So now we have, you know, peer-reviewed papers saying, when will the new normal occur? And that was a direct response to people asking, is this the new normal? The other thing we looked at is, because we were seeing, particularly in the tropics, that at the 2-degree level, you know, we were seeing very high likelihood that every year would be hotter than the historical record. Then we ask, what point between now and 2 degrees is that threshold crossed? Where,
right. what
the temperature distribution? Yeah, exactly. So now we have these maps of what year, and we do it in a probabilistic way. So we're asking, what's the 95th percentile year? What's the 50th percentile year? Right? You create a distribution, and this is getting back to your question about probabilities, right? So now we have these maps of probabilities where we can say there is a 15% probability that at the 2-degree level of global warming, this area of the globe will permanently exceed its historical temperature envelope. It'll never have a summer that's cooler than what used to be the hottest summer. And that's exactly the way we're communicating, is in probabilities.
Has that resonated more with people framing it that way than your initial temp in 2009?
Yeah, so I think that the sense in the scientific community is that real decision makers, whether they're Wall Street bankers or land use planners or U.S. Congress people or engineers.
All of whom I think you talk to.
All of whom I talk to. There's a sense in the scientific community that those people all work in probabilities, that those people are all used to thinking about probabilities. If you say that something has a 15% chance of happening and then it happens, that they will all recognize that that wasn't a wrong prediction. Mm-hmm. Over the last 5 to 10 years, that's absolutely, you know, pretty much all the discussions I've been in, not only with scientists, but also with communication experts, you know, that has very much been the orientation of communicating about climate change. Whether it's sea level rise, you know, the risk of catastrophic loss of land ice, creating, you know, this low probability but high outcome, high consequence event, the extreme heat like we've talked about. I mean, so absolutely the discussion from the scientific community has moved towards these probabilities. Something I've been thinking a lot about lately, particularly since November 8th, is do people really understand probabilities in the way that we thought that they did?
538 came out with a prediction. I think they were the highest one, a probability. I think it was something like 25-30% probability that Trump could win. And they were both simultaneously ridiculed for having this high of a probability, and then post hoc criticized for not having a higher one.
Right. So I've been thinking about this a lot lately. And I actually, on November 9th, I was walking to my office on campus, and I actually stopped, literally stopped, and took out my phone and you know, started writing a note. You know, I have a very long note on my phone because I was, maybe that was just my way of feeling like I had a way of controlling
something,
an outcome. Yeah. But no, I've been thinking about this very question a lot, and 538 is a great example. And I think there are at least three lessons about climate prediction and climate communication from this election that have nothing to do with
you know, is the Clean Power Plan going to get repealed, and is that legally possible? Setting aside all of the political part of it, just in terms of communication,
yeah.
You mentioned 538, and I think they were about, you know, 30% or so for Trump.
I think it was.
The Princeton one was, you know, was real, the real counterpoint to that.
Huffington Post was 2%.
Yeah, the Princeton one was about 1% Trump, 99% Clinton, and the New York Times, you know, on the morning of the election, I'm pretty sure was 84% Clinton and 16% Trump. Like I say, there are three lessons, and one of them is about that spread. So let's come back to that spread, because there's a lesson there. But if we take the middle one, if we take the New York Times and one that's in the middle.
That's called the median prediction.
Yeah, they'll call it the median prediction. It's harmonious with the climate science, climate model analysis literature. But one reason to focus on the New York Times is I was listening to a lot of podcasts before the election, like a lot, like, honey, I'll make dinner again tonight. I got dinner. I'm going to do the dishes. No, I got the dishes. Yeah. Oh, and then I'll take the dog out. Exactly. Like literally, like I was listening to a lot of podcasts, the New York Times. And I, this is not to pick on the New York Times by any means, but these are clearly really smart journalists. I'm sure I'm remembering this correctly, that after the election, on one of the run-up podcasts after the election, one of the New York Times journalists said, we really have to grapple with being so wrong. And, you know, the New York Times' own upshot prediction only had a 16% chance.
And for scientifically, you would say that is not wrong.
Exactly. And so lesson number one is never mind what created the 16% versus 84%, right? So never mind was, you know, what was the source of that spread, the source of that distribution, the source of that uncertainty. Just if we take a prediction that is 84% chance of one thing happening and 16% chance of another thing happening, if that thing happens, from a scientific point of view, that doesn't mean that the prediction was wrong. And so I think lesson number one from, just again, just in terms of climate communication, climate science, the public understanding climate science, climate scientists understanding the public, lesson number one is that there clearly we need to improve the communication about what that means, that there's a 16% chance of something happening, right? So there's a 16% chance that this hurricane will make landfall in this populous area. If that hurricane makes landfall in that populous area, that's not a wrong prediction. And yet if it's interpreted as being wrong, and if people are ignoring the prediction because it's only 16% and they're not evacuating, that's mm-hmm. serious consequences, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I communicate with, say, water managers, right? It is a very common situation for us to be in where 84% of the climate model realizations project an increase in annual precipitation and 16% project a decrease in annual precipitation.
Right.
How we communicate, like that 16% could happen. That decrease could happen. That wouldn't make the prediction wrong.
What do you think is the way forward on the communication of that idea?
We need to better communicate that when we're predicting the future, that there is uncertainty. And I think we've made a lot of progress in that. Scientifically, we've made progress. And clearly, in terms of presidential elections, just the fact that everyone was paying attention to these percentages means that there has been progress made, that it's not a Boolean, she will win, he will lose. You know, you could have an average conversation and people would have a sense of the 538 probability or the upshot probability, right?
Right.
Progress has been made to the point where now the public has a sense that there is a range of outcomes in terms of the prediction. And you see this, like you go to ESPN.com and you're flooded with these win probabilities to the point where now, like it's, you know, halfway through the second quarter and they're published what the win probability of the Lakers is versus the Timberwolves or whatever. I think the public has gotten much more familiar with and comfortable with the idea of probabilities of outcomes. I think what has not yet happened and is very clear from, I think, all the hand-wringing, again, not just the New York Times podcast being one example, but also, you know, clearly much more broadly of people, many, many people saying, how could the predictions have been so wrong? They only had Trump's chances at 30% or at 16%. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think there's still quite a bit of margin for improvement of communicating what does 70% versus 30% probability mean. And for something like evacuation for a weather disaster, you have like the precautionary principle, right? That it's better to have evacuated and the event not to happen than not evacuate and the event happen. There's probably a lot to be learned from the disaster risk reduction community, who's been thinking a lot about how to communicate and how to make decisions within that context. Mm-hmm. What are your acceptable outcomes and your unacceptable outcomes? How much risk of people not trusting you in the future are you willing to take on in order to have certainty that nobody dies? And right, because there's this, you know, the cry wolf syndrome. If the hurricane doesn't make landfall in that location
and everyone evacuated,
do people then not evacuate and then the 16% chance, you know, happens? But I think that's one area where I think we actually do have, the scientific community does have quite a bit of experience working with actual decision makers for actual real life decisions that we now have many years of accumulated wisdom in general. And I think, I mean, with weather prediction in general, right? I mean, everyone's now getting weather forecasts on their phone and making some sort of decision about whether or not to bring an umbrella or whatever decision they're making. So I think there are areas where we have more of a sense of making decisions around probabilities.
That's sort of your first take-home message from your November 9th walk.
Yeah, that's the first one, is that just because something has less than 50% chance of happening in the prediction, if it happens, that doesn't mean that the prediction was wrong.
Right. And
presidential elections only come around every 4 years in the U.S. Extreme weather events happen a lot more frequently than that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we'll face the next version of that much more soon with extreme weather and with climate change, for that matter, than we will for the next presidential election. The second lesson is, there was a lot of debate among kind of the poll aggregation community. Was the 538 number too high? Was the Princeton, at 30% for Trump, likelihood of Trump winning, was the Princeton number too low with a 1% chance of Trump? Was the upshot the right one because it was at 16%, which is basically halfway between the high and the low? Was that the real number? So there's a general analogy with climate models.
Do you skill weight them or not, essentially?
Yeah, there's a lot of climate models and they're different for a lot of, they're all basically the same, but they give different answers because they're not identical. Even if you run the same identical climate model many, many times with slight perturbations to the initial conditions, you end up with a spread of answers that actually, isn't as large as the many models, but is approaching that. The more that people like Clara Desser and her colleagues at NCART devote computing time to asking that question,
it gets bigger and bigger.
30 realizations of one climate model for some variables in some parts of the world look a lot like one realization of 30 different models. Compare those two populations. So there's this whole question of how do we sort through perfectly capable, perfectly well-intended, perfectly objective methods of trying to answer the same question. How do we sort through the different answers that those give? And climate models is one area. Weather forecasts is, again, actually much more longer history of dealing with that question.
But they have a much shorter prediction advantage. They can have repeated instances of evaluation.
Yeah, so it's a shorter term prediction, so it's much more driven by the initial conditions. And they have many more forecasts, exactly, because they're doing it operationally and they're doing it over short time periods. So over a decade you've got a whole lot of forecasts. But there are some lessons, as you're saying, skill weighting versus other methods of aggregation. So for climate models, for weather forecasts, I think also for extreme event attribution, we're in a period now that's actually pretty analogous to at least the level at which I understand the presidential poll aggregation groups and their methods. I think the extreme event attribution community is actually at a pretty similar place where you have a number of groups basically trying to calculate the same number, right? And asking the same question, testing the same hypothesis.
And this is for real-time extremes that are taking place. People are looking at the models and trying to attribute the fractional risk that was generated by human activities.
Exactly. If multiple groups ask, what is the contribution of anthropogenic global warming been to the level of Arctic sea ice right now?
Yes.
I'm not
totally certain, but my prediction would be you'd get a spread pretty similar to that presidential election outcome spread. I think they'd all be on one side. I think you're right, because of the thermodynamic effect of warming, I think all the methods would say global warming has increased the probability.
But then they would have variations in their simulations of black carbon or ocean heat transport or whatever it might be.
Exactly. So there'd be all these methodological differences, these choices that people are making, that would create this spread in the number. And we're at the point now where groups are using peer-reviewed methods to produce real-time analyses. And I think if we had three groups doing that, we would probably get three numbers like the 538, 30%.
Which from the public perception creates this image that scientists don't know what they're doing, that they can't agree on the answer, they can't agree on the approaches or the models, and that it could be anything from a very small effect to a huge effect.
Precisely. Just like with 538 being at 30% and Princeton, Huffington Post being around 1% or 2%, New York Times being at 15%, I think in an extreme event attribution, we're at a similar place where you have real scientists using real scientific methods, but making different methodological choices that are creating this uncertainty that's basically methodological uncertainty in how the analysis is being done.
And then, but cynically, this plays exactly into the postmodern ideas of science, which is that any approach or any idea is equally valid, regardless of its actual scientific underpinnings.
Yeah, and I think part of our responsibility as scientists is to do as much as we can to understand what the contributions are to those differences.
Yeah.
And we need transparency. We need intercomparison. And the climate modeling community, the weather forecasting community, have both been very good about making coordinated efforts to put everything on the table and say, wherever each of us falls is where we fall. We're going to run the same experiment, and then we'll know how our answers differ because of everything else, not because we're running a different experiment in the case of the model, the climate model and the comparison project.
So the second lesson from November 9th might be something like, we need to accept the presence of these major structural differences among models, but then keep working at understanding the reasons for those differences and trying to reduce the range as much as possible.
Yeah, and I think that just because different groups find different answers doesn't mean that scientists don't understand how the world works.
Exactly.
And that we can learn from those differences, particularly if we approach the question in a transparent and collaborative way. And then the third question has to do with the rarity of the event. And we really are experiencing, you know, year after year, events that fall totally outside of our historical experience, and the Arctic, you know, the Arctic temperatures right now, the Arctic sea ice,
or just 2016 temperatures,
2016 global temperatures, California drought. I mean, you go around the world every year, and there's a plethora of events that are totally outside of our historical experience.
I come across this editorially at Nature a lot, where we have papers that are in the overall category of contextualizing modern climate change, and a lot of them are showing regional records that are outside the range of historical variability or over the past millennium. And it's becoming progressively harder to send those papers out to review because they tend to reach the same conclusion.
So there are a couple implications there. It has been said that the null hypothesis should be that climate change has happened, and therefore for thermodynamic effects, say for warming, for melting of ice, for water vapor in the atmosphere, that the null hypothesis is basically that global warming has had an impact.
Yeah.
So I got asked recently, is it surprising that this group has posted a result saying that global warming has made these Arctic temperatures much more likely? From a non-scientific point of view, you know, if we know that theoretically, increasing greenhouse gases increases the amount of energy going into the climate system, which increases the mean temperature. If observationally we know that historically the Arctic has been warming, and we know that the Arctic has been
losing sea ice, you know, in terms of the long-term trend, then would, just from a non-scientific point of view, if you told everybody that, would you say, so do you think that the probability of really low sea ice and really warm conditions in the Arctic has increased? And from a non-scientific point of view, I think, you know, parsimoniously, people would say, yeah, I think that probability has gone up. It's a long way of summarizing the case that at some point, the null hypothesis is, yeah, I mean, global warming's had an impact. To your point at Nature, like, people don't submit a paper on every weather forecast anymore, right? Like, that's not, right? I mean, it's operational. And at some point, that will happen with detection of climate change. At some point, that will happen with attribution of climate change. And we're certainly seeing it with individual event attribution. My own research group, right? Like, we're not... There was a point where if we found an event to be interesting, it was new enough that we could pursue an analysis of it, try to diagnose the causes, ask the question whether or not global warming had changed the odds of the conditions, whether or not it had affected the severity, and be confident that writing that up and submitting that would be sufficiently new that it would be worthwhile for a journal.
Right, right.
Like, it's harder for me to answer that question. Like, you know, there's an event just about every day. You know, I appreciate what the weather risk attribution, World Weather Attribution Group is doing in sort of saying these are our peer review methods and we can, you know, be transparent and document how we are analyzing this individual event, but it's not necessarily... Each event isn't necessarily a paper, just like,
yeah, exactly.
Like each weather forecast isn't a paper anymore. But the reality is that we are getting these events that are they are outside of anything that anybody living has experienced. And they're outside of what our historical records show. It's hard to attribute those kinds of events to any individual cause because the odds that any one factor caused the event are very low, right? I mean, it's pretty much...
They're all multifactorial. Well, not, all I shouldn't say all.
No, I mean, they pretty much... So anytime from a climate... For the climate system, anytime there's an event, an individual event that falls outside of the historical distribution, variability played a role, right? Like, there's absolutely a role of variability. Just noise, because that's the only way to get that far outside of distribution. And the question really is, did other factors, in addition to the background variability, did other factors increase the odds of hitting that threshold, or did it raise the threshold of the severity of what that event would have been without those other factors? This is a third lesson of the election and the communication around prediction, and now after the election, the communication around cause and effect. So, I listen to podcasts, I read the news, right? Like, I'm seeing a lot of consternation about what caused Trump to win. Clinton did win the popular vote. So that's, you have a situation where, situation where in the mean, you have, you know, one direction, but because of the Electoral College, the spatial nuance actually really does matter, right? And if it's something on the order of 100,000 votes that could have tipped the Electoral College, that there actually are analogs to how we understand what are the causes of these unprecedented events.
Getting way back to your earlier comments on your exposure to the Earth system ideas of feedbacks, nonlinearities, you could have a situation where a latent heat cooling effect suddenly gets shut off in a system, and then you get pushed where everything is going into sensible heat, and you have a massive spike in an extreme event.
So someone might say, well, was that event caused by variability? Because, you know, really it would have been a heat wave either way. Well, that's true, right? It would have been a heat wave either way. But would it have been as hot without that soil moisture feedback? No, it wouldn't have been as hot without that soil moisture feedback. Well, then did land use change cause that soil moisture feedback?
Mm-hmm.
I listened to plenty of podcasts about politics, and I've been hearing these arguments about, well, you know, was it Comey's letter that made the 100,000 vote difference? Was it Russian hacking that made the 100,000 vote difference?
The answer is yes to all of those things.
Right. So the answer is that when we have these complex events in the climate system that have multiple contributing factors, each one of those can change the probability.
Mm-hmm. When we're looking at has global warming influenced the California drought, we're not saying that had there been no global warming, we would have had five wet years, right? We're not saying that. What we're saying is that, you know, warming has made it much more likely that when low precipitation happens, the ambient conditions are much warmer because of global warming. And the combination of low precipitation and high temperature substantially increases the probability that that low precipitation produces drought because of evaporation from soils, because of transpiration from plants, because of melting of snow, because of more precipitation falling as rain rather than snow, particularly at lower elevations, right? These are all the ways in which that extra heat that's measured by the high temperature interacts with low precipitation. So we're not arguing that global warming made there be low precipitation, and instead, had there been no global warming, these 5 years would have been five wet years, right? Noise absolutely played a role, but we wouldn't have gotten to the level of drought that we've gotten to without global warming. And the odds that this happens again are much higher because global warming has already happened than if had there been no global warming at all. And so I think that some of these debates about cause and effect, right, it really is the summation of the ingredients that affects the odds that these outcomes happen. And if you have changing odds in multiple ingredients, you're changing the odds that they co-occur overall. And so I think there's a third analogy in trying to understand what caused this particular outcome, where the outcome is so close to being on one side of the line or the other, that's very analogous to how we're trying to understand the cause of individual extreme events.
No, I'm really glad that the elections have had the positive effect of having you think more deeply about climate communication issues. Thanks a lot for the chat.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
That was my interview with Noah Diffenbaugh from Stanford University. Noah, thanks a lot for talking. We got so far into the kind of philosophical aspects that I actually didn't get to a lot of things that I wanted to talk with Noah about. He's the chief editor for Geophysical Research Letters, and was hoping to chat about some issues there and how they're handling the journal and dealing with gender diversity in the reviewing process. Other issues are like, what's it like to be an academic living in Silicon Valley, both culturally and financially, but maybe next time. As always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guest, and not necessarily those of Nature or Nature's publisher. If you'd like the show, you can check it out on Google Play, and it's also on iTunes and Stitcher. You can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. On Twitter, I'm at MWClimateSci. And coming up, I'll be talking with Nerali Abram, and hopefully Gabe Vecchi and Jennifer McKinnon will be upcoming guests as well. I'll talk to you soon.